All right. So an officer, actually, what's funny about this is that we talked about this situation actually during our webinar. So the officer is from, I don't know actually where he's from. So he says, there's a case out there called United States versus Banks. And it's a decision where a person is wanted, you know, and he is on his, this is actually a Ninth Circuit case. So the cops see him on his porch and they have probable cause to arrest him. And they go up to his porch, his curtilage, and they make the arrest. Okay. And so the problem is the cop says, look, I find this strange because the court said the arrest was unlawful. And so the cop says, look, why was this deemed to be an unlawful, you know, arrest? Because the guy was on his porch. We could see him from the street. But remember, the problem is that the cop is going on to somebody's curtilage with the sole purpose to make an arrest. And it doesn't jive with the Constitution when you are trying to go onto curtilage without any agency, without a warrant. And the next thing is you have to look for consent, right? That's crew. Consent, recognized exceptions, warrant. Well, where is your consent? You probably don't have consent to enter a person's curtilage just to make the arrest. Okay. So that's the answer there. All right. Mike Brave. Okay, so let's talk about that. So Mike Brave, who is a fellow attorney and specializes definitely in use of force, he says, look, a lot of cops do not understand arguable probable cause and the collective knowledge doctrine. All right, let's talk about it. So the arguable probable cause is a standard that's used mostly with search warrants, even though, Mike, I have seen it used with warrantless arrests, which I personally don't like, because it's usually held to a higher standard. But arguable probable cause is this idea is that if the officer has a warrant, and let's say a search warrant, and when we go to a suppression hearing, the court does determine that search warrant is deficient. Oh snap, that's way too much for me. Is deficient. Mike, do you want to get on the, is that Mike's quote? I can't see the whole thing. Hey, Mike, do you want to get on the, let's get you on the mic. Mike, can we turn on your microphone? All right, let's talk to Brave.
Yes, sir.
All right, what you got?
Well, where these came up was I was sitting in, I'm an expert in a particular case, and I was sitting in on the deposition of a plaintiff's expert who's nationally known. Everybody here would probably likely know him. And it was interesting that when he was trying to defend his so-called opinions, he did not even know what arguable probable cause was, nor did he know what the collective knowledge doctrine was. And therefore, he said they didn't apply and he couldn't apply them because he had never heard of them before.
Wow. Now, is he a cop and attorney, or I don't even know his name, but what's his profession?
He was a police officer for a few years. Now he's a PhD living in academia, but he's doing an awful lot of expert witness work around the U.S. on use of force as well as search and seizure.
Hmm. All right. Well, look, the way I explain arguable probable cause, Mike, and you tell me what view you take on it. But again, mostly for search warrants, right? Arrest warrants, search warrants, mainly for search warrants.
Can I shorten this for you?
Yeah, please do.
The whole point is, in order for an officer to arrest someone, et cetera, they have to have probable cause. However, to have civil liability against them, the standard is only arguable probable cause, meaning you still have to have the probable cause in order to arrest, et cetera. However, in order to get beyond the civil threshold of liability for the officers, that standard is arguable probable cause. That's the distinction.
And I think that helps, because it's like, even if the charges were dropped, even if the prosecutor says, hey, look, we're not going to move forward with these charges because there's no probable cause. If the cop had argued probable cause, then civilly, they don't pay money, correct?
Yes.
Now, argued probable cause is basically where it almost, the way I read it, it's like, I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating here, but it's almost like the court says, if any reasonable officer out there could have thought that this was probable cause, then we don't pay money. Is that close?
Yes. Basically, Malley versus Briggs said that officers' opinions can differ. So therefore, as long as the probable cause is arguable, even if in a judge's chambers it is later determined that they did not actually have probable cause, the officer still gets qualified immunity and does not face civil damages.
Yeah. Now, I personally like arguable probable cause used in the context of search warrants. I've seen it more. I've seen out of 10 cases I've seen where they mention arguable probable cause, 9 of them are search warrants. Is that something you also observed?
Yes.
And I like that too, because we always want to give officers more leeway when they decide to go to a judicial, you know, they get judicial approval versus doing things on their own. However, you do bring up a good point. We're not talking about criminal charges. We're not talking about, you know, at the end of the day, if the cop did not have probable cause, let's say, technically speaking, they did not have probable cause, and let's say we arrested the person and search incident to arrest, they find drugs and so forth. Yeah, maybe the consequence is that, you know, the criminals to go free because the constable blundered. But we're talking about money exchanging hands, and arguable probable cause is really about not penalizing an officer who made in one way, a good faith mistake. I guess that's one way of looking at it.
Yes, you could also compare it to mistake of fact shootings. Somebody produces what the officer believes reasonably perceives as a firearm, and the officer shoots him. It turns out to be a wallet or a phone or something. That's a mistake of fact shooting. It's literally the same thing. There's the thresholds of law allow the officers to make those mistakes, especially under stressful conditions, under totality of circumstances.
Yeah. Now, one thing. Okay. So, look, I the arguable probable cause, I can understand that some people, you know, if you're getting paid expert witness money and you have, you know, yachts and airplanes like you do because of the money you make on expert witness stuff, I understand you should know what arguable probable cause is. But what about collective knowledge doctrine? This expert witness did not know what collective knowledge was?
Correct. He had never heard the term before. And in this case, that was key because it was an officer involved shooting. And basically there was a lot of information that a lot of other people had, including this person's background. And the plaintiff's expert said that's all irrelevant because the officer did not personally know it. And when he was asked about the collective knowledge doctrine, he'd never heard of it before, even though I think he first served as a police officer, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And then he went on to academia after that.
Now, some people know collective knowledge as the fellow officer rule. You've heard of that too?
I have, but there's one distinction you need to be aware of is that it usually applies to encounter, stop, frisk, and arrest, which is usually where the collective knowledge doctrine applies, including with dispatch, of course. The problem is there's only 1.5 circuits, meaning federal circuits, meaning there's only one where it's actually been held to be appropriate in the use of an officer's use of deadly force. And in the Second Circuit, not the Second Circuit, but a Second Circuit, there was one case that quoted the 11th Circuit that said it could be used, but it said that this circuit has not adopted that yet, but here's a circuit that did. So the point is collective knowledge doctrine, encounter, stop, frisk, arrest, you're probably good to go. If it comes to attempting to use that to justify the use of deadly force, you better hope and pray you're in the 11th Circuit if you do that. Because the Ninth Circuit specifically said that they have not adopted that.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's some politics there too, you know, giving somebody a pass because of shooting somebody when in their mind it wasn't justified. It shouldn't have been justified objectively, but then having another officer somewhere on scene saying, hey, I could have shot him. Right?
Let me flip that a little bit. Officer A screams, my God, he's got his gun. He's got a gun. He's about to shoot you. So you shoot him. Even though you did not justify that in your own brain with your own observations that he was about to shoot you, so therefore you can shoot him. You're totally basing it off another officer's statement, and that's where this is likely to come into play in certain circumstances.
Yeah. Okay. So Gerald says his wife is vacuuming. You know, that sounds like my wife. My wife is a perpetual vacuumer. All right. Well, look, that's interesting. No, and so I'm glad you came on because, look, so the lesson of the day right so far is arguable probable cause. It is a civil standard that basically helps our officers when they don't necessarily have probable cause. They can also say that, hey, look, you still don't pay money because you have arguable probable cause, and collect the knowledge doctrine, which is a very common police doctrine. All right. Are we good? I think we're good. All right. Thanks, Mike. All right. All right. So this question I do. Okay. So let's talk about this case. And then also, if you want to get on the mic and also do like what Brave did, and you have a question and so forth, that's what we're kind of here for. That's what I want this podcast to be, so we can have a dialogue. All right. So this officer says, hey, can we deflate tires, basically? So the cop says, I have a simple, cheap tool that can unscrew the valve in the valve stem of a tire. It does zero damage, and when tightened, can be refilled with a portable air compressor. I also carry it. This officer is prepared to do some deflating. Now, I haven't done it yet, but my question is this. Let's say you have a scenario such as an unconscious sleeping driver who is passed out in an unsafe or odd place that suggests impairment, like at the stoplight, right? Can a tire or two be pre-deflated? What about if there is plain view PC for an arrest as well, such as drugs or paraphernalia in plain view, which would explain why they're passed out? My thought is being there to prevent a dangerous pursuit if they wake up and try to take off. Why not spikes, one might ask? I've heard that sometimes when placed in front of a steel tire, they just get laid over instead of puncturing the tire. All right. So let's first of all, talk about, if this is a search or seizure, right? Do you think that if we purposely deflate a tire, that would be a seizure under the Fourth Amendment? Yes or no? Yeah. I think the answer is yes, because the definition that I use for a seizure is when, and I think a good case might be U.S. versus Jacobson, is where when the officer, the government, intentionally interferes with a person's possessory interest. In other words, when the police do something to somebody's effect, possession, and they can no longer use it like they would intend to use it, that is a seizure. And Gerald says, my agency has a device called a piranha. It's a small pocket-sized spike strip. The tire is deflated when the subject tries to flee, and so forth. Okay, so I think it is a seizure. Now, the question is, do we have crew, right? Anytime you have a search or seizure, you want to look at crew. Do you have their consent? Obviously not. Do you have a warrant? Obviously not. I'll do bookends. Do you have a recognized exception? Do you think the courts would understand and be, do you think that this would be like reasonable to try to prevent them from fleeing? And the answer is yes. I think that it would be justified. I think that the courts would understand why you're doing it. But that's not the end all. I do think that there is a concern that you also may have some liability there, because now when they try to escape, they definitely have a car that is not going to operate like they think it's going to operate. And so, what happens if they hit the gas and the car, instead of going straight, veers to the left and right and crashes? And the plaintiff can kind of prove that the vehicle probably would have went straight back onto the freeway, but instead careened to the left and actually hurt somebody. Can the officer actually be liable for that? And I think that the answer is yes, right? I mean, at least there can be an argument that there might be, some needless liability there. The thing about spike strips that make things a little differently as well, first of all, the regular spike strips that were issued for pursuits, they deflate the tire very slowly, so it gives the person time to control the vehicle. Now, there are these piranha, I guess, but there are spike strips that deflate the tire immediately. Isn't that kind of doing the same thing? I guess, but maybe that device has been tested, and maybe it has a little bit more scientific backing about how the car is controlled, and it gives them time to maybe pull over and so forth. So it's just. It's something to consider. Now, me personally, So always piranha the passenger side. So, oh, I see. That's a stop-stick device. Interesting. So me personally, why not just block the car in? Isn't that what a lot of cops do anyway, guys? Aren't you blocking cars in, like, physically, you know? Wouldn't that be the better move? So I don't teach tactics. I teach the law. But I don't know. That's my consideration. I'd rather prevent them, the pinch maneuver and so forth. I'd rather prevent them from leaving in the first place. Yeah. All right. That's all I can answer on that. I don't know. I mean, when it comes to liability and tort claims, that's definitely not, you know, I really don't know what the liability could be. I also want cops to consider the department policy and training. Does your agency train you on deflating tires, or is this something that you're just doing on your own? If you're doing it on your own, is it really worth it to like do something that your agency has not signed off on? It's something to fanboy. It's something to consider. So I really, all right, Robert, put him on what for Mike? All right, put him on.
Hi, Anthony. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Make a traffic stop, and dispatch informs me that the subject has a warrant, and I detain him pending confirmation of the warrant. Can I then ask them for consent to search the vehicle because I believe that there's other criminal activity going on, such as drugs?
Yeah. Now, where are you from? Texas?
Florida.
Oh, upper Florida. Right.
Yes, sir.
Like the panhandle?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the answer is yes. So the case I want to use there is United States versus Watson, 1976. And there, the Supreme Court said that just because a person may be in arrest-like custody, right, in handcuffs, in the back of a police car, even in your situation, the guy's not formally arrested yet, but he's on his way, right?
Correct.
But the point is, just because the person is really like in arrest-like custody does not mean that they cannot give consent to search. And I can tell you right now, my friends, many, many people, the cops, think that if a person is under arrest or in handcuffs or things like that, that they cannot legally give consent to search because they feel that it's going to be coercion. Is that kind of how what you're getting feedback on? Like that's kind of things you heard?
Yes, and I have a follow-on to that, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead, right now. Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Scenario, traffic stop. The person is DWLSR with knowledge.
But back up. I'm missing something. What'd you say?
They make a traffic stop, and the subject is driving while license suspended or revoked.
That's what I'm missing. Driving while license suspended. Okay.
Right. And
yep.
They're going to arrest him at that point, still can ask for consent and he can give it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that really is the epitome or the holding of Watson, right? Is that a person under arrest still has the mental capacity to and the authority to, you know, to give consent to search. And so the point is that being under arrest is one factor under voluntariness. Now, I do want to say this though, right? I don't want cops to think that, hey, you know, if you get consent to search from somebody who's under arrest, it's the same thing. The articulation and the legal issues are the same as if the person's free to leave. I think we can all agree, right, that if the person is free to go, the level of coercion surrounding that encounter is much less than if they're than the back of a police car, right?
Yes.
So what the court is looking for here is that you want to do things proactively to reduce or minimize the level of coercion. And you do things like, hey, speaking with them in a conversational tone, don't badgering the person. You know, the one thing that the Supreme Court liked in Watson was letting them know they have a right to refuse. Now, you know, in Florida, unlike some states like Colorado and some other states, and New Jersey, you don't have to tell them they have a right to refuse. However, and I generally speaking don't recommend that because a lot of people take you up on it. However, when you have a situation where the person is in handcuffs, especially in the back of the police car, under arrest or not, and you're seeking their consent, you should, it is a pro tip, you should tell them they have a right to refuse, among other good practices, not surround them and so forth, when you ask for that consent, because that helps prove that they were not coerced into consent. So the answer is U.S. versus Watson, U.S. Supreme Court. That's good case law in Florida, which is a Fourth Amendment, state, as you know. Your yes. state constitution requires that you comply with the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's my answer. U.S. versus Watson.
That's great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, my friend. All right. Now, one thing I would have said if you were still on the mic, but I'll just tell you real quick. It does help if you are going to get their consent to search their car. I've seen it. I've seen people on the arrest search house, like give consent to search houses. It does help if they're on scene and you don't take them away. I think that's like a. I think that's kind of obvious. But sometimes I've seen it where the cops will get consent to search a person's home for, as a crime scene without a warrant, and they take the guy away to process him. Not a pro tip. Not a pro tip. All right, we have another person that wants to ask Mike. Well, Gerald wants to ask him a question. Gerald, what's your question? There's no dumb questions here.
Get him on the mic.
Get him on the mic. And William, he's next.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, and just real quick, I also, my friends online, look at what Brandon Jones said. I like that. That's actually, that's very good. I might steal that, Brandon. All right, what's up, my friend?
So again, maybe a silly question, off topic. I said, hey, I'm about to go on a microphone. And my wife's exact words were, I guess I can't vacuum now. And it is 10:30 at night here. So yeah, feel my pain, Anthony.
All right.
So my question has to do with using drones for traffic enforcement. I'm in charge of a traffic unit in my agency. We're small but mighty. We have one intersection where there's a huge issue with folks running a left-hand red arrow. My suggestion was put a drone in the air, watch these cars run the red light, and have stop teams positioned, you know, south and north of the intersection. And the drone operator can call out the vehicle makes and models for the traffic stops. My agency and our county attorney shot it down. What do you what? Feel?
Are you in Maryland?
I am in Maryland. Yes.
But I'm not aware of any law. And look, I'm not an expert in law. You know, I'm expert in, I definitely feel I'm pretty confident in Maryland case law, but I'm not aware of any Maryland law that says you cannot observe traffic with a drone. In fact, I'm not aware of any law in any state that says you can't observe traffic with a drone. And are they saying that it's a constitutional issue?
They won't really give an answer. We don't like it. We think there's a lot of gray area. We feel like it's, quote, sketchy. But, like, I can't get anybody to sit down and tell me why it's a no-go.
All I can tell you is that if I was in charge over there with what I know about Maryland law and case law, I would be good to go with it. I'm not saying that we're going to do it or not do it. I'm just saying that would not be my hindrance, right? My reservation would not be that it's a legal issue. Because at the end of the day, how is this person, the person who got the red light ticket, what are they going to say in court? They're going to say that my rights were violated, that this drone in the air can't see me running a red light, that I have a reasonable expectation of privacy that was violated. Because one thing that we do know is that traffic cameras see the same thing. And doesn't Maryland have red light cameras?
Maryland has red light cameras. They have speed cameras, and we are instituting school bus cameras that are catching people running by the school buses.
Yeah, of course, because you guys love your draconian state over there. You guys love enforcement.
Hey, you listen, know? I just work here.
No, I know. I mean, you guys, you know, you want to pick on the common man, but they can't have no guns for self-defense. So, and there's this now FFA rules. John says FFA rules. Look, I'm kind of familiar with 107, right? Part 107, which covers drones. As long as you're not hovering over moving vehicles, right? Unless it's your own vehicle, you're not hovering over moving vehicles. That's fine. But you wouldn't need to do that. You would be off center, right? You would be over some open grass or something, correct?
Well, the intersection I'm thinking of, and when you come to Maryland to teach, I'll buy you a whiskey and I'll show you a Google map. But yeah, there's a huge open area right next to the intersection where the bird could hover and like kind of point the camera towards where the violations are occurring.
Yeah,
so we're look, flying so over top of cars.
Right. So you're not violating FAA rules. You're not over people. You're not over, you're not a danger. You shouldn't be over traffic when these things anyway. So no. Yeah, Phil says, unless you have an airspace. Look, I do not see a legal or constitutional issue with doing enforcement. Frankly, it's clever because it probably will send a pretty good, you can probably get a lot of people. Now, the other thing is that police have been doing aircraft traffic enforcement for decades, like literally, like probably over 50 years, you know what I'm saying? Like in California and so forth. So as far as when I teach drone case law, we always start with the cases that harken back to fixed wing aircraft, right? And then helicopters and now drones. So when it comes to fixed wing aircraft, they fly over interstates all the time and find speeders. So I don't see any constitutional difference.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Who's next? Yeah. Huh?
But he's on a cell phone, so we're gonna try.
All right. Let's try him. And Tim, just while we're getting him on the phone, Tim, I think is probably onto something. Tim says that it's probably an optics issue, the drone surveilling traffic. I agree. I think it just doesn't feel right. They think it's maybe a little dirty or something like that. Maybe they don't want to. And also, actually, we got to recognize that Gerald works in a smaller town. Smaller towns have way more politics than big towns because they can, you know, the populace can affect the outcome of elections and so forth a lot easier in small towns. So I'm not a politician, right? So if the mayor or the chief wants to say, look, we can do it, yes, but we're not going to do it because we don't want the backlash, then fine. At least you got a reason. What's up, William?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. So I'll reach out to you on an issue we ran across. It's probably off topic. We have some supervisors telling me at work that there's no such thing as an investigatory stop for a vehicle. So you can't Terry stop a vehicle. And the only way that you can stop the vehicle is if you have probable cause. My argument is using your probable cause and reasonable suspicion booklet, Strive for 5, they're saying that's a no-go.
Wait, back up. You said before you said no go. What about my book? And they said no go?
Using your Strive for 5.
Oh, Strive for 5.
Strive for 5. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
What state are you in?
Oklahoma.
That is absolutely untrue.
I didn't think it was true. I think the issue I'm having is verbiage, is what I believe. They're saying you can't Terry stop a vehicle.
Okay, all right. Let me see if I can really, if I have some really good skills here and pull something up in the meantime, but that is just fundamentally absurd. I'm just saying it's absurd.
Let me drop some, what I ran across, and they were saying this is definitely a no-go. There's a high crime area, gang drugs, just had a shooting in the area a few days prior to this. I was in the area because the victim of the shooting was being harassed by the shooter, but every time you go in the area, the shooter runs away, you can't find him. High crime area, again, 1 o'clock in the morning, known drug, apartment building, vehicle parked out front with the brake lights on, nobody in or out. I watch it for 2 or 3 minutes. They see me. I shine my lights in the car. They freak out a little bit, drive around to the backside of the apartment complex. A male runs out of the apartment, jumps in the passenger seat. They still don't move. And then he gets out the car after not even a minute. And so I jump out on both of them. And they said, that's not reasonable suspicion, and I need probable cause to make that stop.
Well, look, that's a lot. I want to kind of separate these things out into two issues. Number one, I don't really, whether or not it's reasonable suspicion is one thing, right?
Yes.
But I want to get involved in the whole, you can't stop a car for reasonable suspicion? Are they saying, look, in this situation, it's not reasonable suspicion? Or are they saying, even if you had reasonable suspicion, you can't stop that car?
They said, even if I had it. So they're saying both. They're saying that what I saw was not reasonable suspicion, that he could have been doing anything, or that person in that vehicle could have been doing anything. But in the broader scheme of things, that you can't do a terror stop on a vehicle. I know that's not true. I know you can. But well, I do.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you did your magic and you can throw a case at me, I will gladly throw it out and see what's read it up and throw it out when I go back to work tomorrow.
Well, but here's the thing, the good news and the bad news. The bad news is I'm not going to be able to find a case. I'm not going to be able to find a case to say, hey, you are correct. You can stop that car based on reasonable suspicion. And the thing is, we obviously understand that people can have their opinions.
Yes, sir.
And so, look, that's what people get paid to be, bars and stars, right? If they want to say, yeah, it's one thing to say, look, I don't think you have reasonable suspicion here, and they give their opinion, and you give your opinion. However, if they're saying, even if you had reasonable suspicion, you could not make that stop, that clearly is not the law.
Oklahoma. That's what I'm being told. Even if I had reasonable suspicion, I would have to wait until I had probable cause to make that stop.
Absolutely.
Now, granted, obviously, if the vehicle moves, I would rather wait and get that vehicle on a traffic stop.
All right,
I'm going to get the video. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Okay, but hold on. Not hold on. What I mean to say is this: and Rick, make sure you get his email address. So no matter what, if I can't find the case tonight, I'm going to find something before we're done. So even if I lost my train of thought when I was, hold on. I lost my train of thought. What was the last thing you said?
Obviously I would want to, if
oh yes,
the opportunity presented itself, I'd want probable. I'd make the stop on whatever probable cause stop I can make.
Right. Okay. Look, I do want to talk about that, because I do think that a lot of officers are depending too much on the pretext traffic stop, which is what you're talking about there. Okay. And the pretext traffic stop, United States versus Wren, 1996 or whatever, whatever it is, mid 90s. Fine. I get it. Right. But I'm trying to get officers in the future with my report writing class and so forth to embrace reasonable suspicion. Embrace it. Stop that damn car. If you have reasonable suspicion, stop it for reasonable suspicion. And the reason why is because we know, based on the case called Rodriguez, that if we're going to make a pretext traffic stop, we do not get a lot of latitude. We do not get to demand ID from passengers. We do not get to extend that traffic stop to call the detective who works gun crimes and be like, hey, what do you know about this dude, right? But when we have that reasonable suspicion stop, it's a totally different set of rules in a sense, right? We get to take a diligent amount of time. We can run more databases. We can call Epic, which is border crossings. We can call our friends at the Bureau. And, my point is, let's start as a profession embracing reasonable suspicion. And tell these judges with confidence, judge, look you in the eye. I had reasonable suspicion for, and I do call it a strive for five reasons or more, give or take, right? It's a metric. It's a guidepost. It's not gospel, right? But Your Honor, here's the five reasons that I stopped these men in this neighborhood. Boom, 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 boom. And that's why I think they're up to criminal activity. And if your judge still disagrees, you can't control that. But that's what we're looking for, I think, right? Because these traffic stops, these pretext traffic stops, don't get you that far.
They limit you too much, in my experience.
Yeah, they limit you.
Yes, sir. Yes,
they limit you. So,
and you're gonna find more reasonable suspicion, I believe, because you do jump out on pedestrians, and you can find a lot of stuff. But people get wrapped up in the, well, you can't do this unless you have the probable cause for the traffic stop. So, well, I just seen what I seen, and it's obviously something's going on, because even the driver, once I made the arrest, even the driver of the vehicle, I explained it to the driver, and they were like, yeah, that's suspicious.
Yeah.
On the scene, the driver told me it's suspicious. So, I mean.
Yeah.
I think.
Look, I wish I was emperor, you know, and I could be like, no, you have reasonable suspicion, and my word goes. People do have their proclivities and they have their own personal experiences and so forth. However, reasonable suspicion is. Oh, look, I think I actually found your case right here. Hold on.
Oh.
That's what I do, my friend. I bring joy and happiness to the people. Hold on. I'm on Westlaw, you know, which is.
Yes, sir.
It's like crack for lawyers. Yeah, I mean, look, here's a case called State versus Strawn. It says, let me see if it actually has a good quote in here. It says, blah, 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 blah. So basically there's a hold on, is this right here? Yeah. Yeah, so look, here it is right here. It says that the driver said that the trooper lacked unlawfully prolonged the stop because of a traffic stop without reasonable suspicion beyond the time needed to address the traffic violation. We're kind of talking about that, right? The pretext stop and so forth. And the driver reasoned that the video traffic stop, you know, did not show extreme nervousness that the trooper claimed and so forth. However, the court said that the trooper did supply reasonable suspicion under the totality of the circumstances, the T to the O to the C, to prolong the traffic stop to further investigate after writing the warning. So this case directly, it's a court of criminal appeals of Oklahoma, 2018. And let me give the case to Richard. Actually, no, you can't do that. You can't do it like that. I can't put it into the chat, but I can say that the citation. You ready for it?
Hey, yes, sir.
It's.
Or you can email me.
Well, it won't work on that computer.
You can send it to me. I'll send it in.
Well, I'm just going to tell you to it right now, so we can always. It's State versus Strawn, Strawn. The citation number, it's out of Oklahoma. It's 419-P3D-249-2018.
All right, I got it.
All right, and there's actually, I did my little search and 15 cases came up talking about reasonable suspicion and traffic stops. All right.
I think we just follow the rules that are already established. We'll be all right.
Yeah, directly. No, look, there's a lot of, you know, humans are humans. Okay. I mean, I can understand. I have my, if I was selected as a Supreme Court justice, you better bet that I'm going to disagree with some of my colleagues. Right. And that is fine. That's human beings disagree. But if you have a person who's saying that you cannot make a reasonable suspicion stop of a motor vehicle in Oklahoma, that is dead wrong. Now in New York, you better not be stopping a vehicle for anything, including murder. But Oklahoma is still a good state. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. All right. Do I have anybody else, Rick? All right. So I want to answer a question real quick about it has to do. What time is it? All right. Let's do a few more minutes. And hopefully we'll get one more caller to ask a question, because these are great. These are absolutely great. These officers that are asking these questions are asking very good questions, except Gerald. His questions were ridiculous. Drones and traffic violations. What the hell? All right. I'm waiting for the laugh right there. All right. So Ricky, you got the email address right there. So we'll email him some more. He's gone. All right. So let me ask you this. Can officers ask a hotel or motel? Do you know the difference in a hotel and a motel? Rick, do you know what the difference is?
Nope.
You don't? Get out of here. You don't know?
One has outside facing doors and one has a corridor.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a motel has outside facing doors. A hotel has internal. And that's why motels are shitholes, because you don't want your door facing the elements. You know what I mean? So, all right. So this cop is saying, hey, can we go to the motels, for example, and ask them for their registry? And if they give it to us, can we run those person for once? What's the answer? Yes or no? All right. No, no, no. Is Sean still here, Rick? My boy, Sean. Sean says yes. Sean for the win. Justin says yes. The answer is yes. All right. So what's going on here is this, okay? You cannot demand a hotel registry. And many of you that are saying no are probably thinking of that it violates a case called Los Angeles versus Patel, right? Oh, Michael Brave has something too. Hey, Mike, can you send it to me too? Don't forget me in this stuff. I want to also get that stuff. So the case is Los Angeles versus Patel. And what happened there briefly is that the city of Los Angeles had a ordinance that their local hotels had to turn over their guest registry to basically LAPD. And LAPD ran people for wants. That is unconstitutional, right? You can't demand a business to start turning over their private records like that so that they can start doing these criminal investigations. That is a Fourth Amendment issue that's not necessary to run to for business records, right? However, what this officer is saying is something different. Asking a business for their records is covered under third-party data. In other words, generally speaking, there are always some caveats. When a business has lawful business records and the government comes in and says, hey, can I consensually look at your business records? And that business says, yes, that is covered by the third party data doctrine, which basically means there is no privacy interest in your data that a third party holds. Therefore, if you are going to stay at the Hampton Inn and your name ends up getting turned over voluntarily to your local police department and you have a warrant and they serve it on you, that is on you. All right? That's how that works. And you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy as long as the police did not demand the information. Now, there's always caveats. There's always exceptions, you know, demanding things. Or, you know, there might be racial profiling issues, you know, stuff like that, a due process. But just their name and DOB, just to run people, the answer is no. Change the facts, change the answer. All right, that's all I got for you.